the attitude, and I think I say every year, you guys are just so real to me here in Lyman. I appreciate that so much. Your love for the lost, love for the brethren, and love for God, and that's just really encouraging. So, really appreciate Marshall having me back this year. I found it kind of interesting, you know. I every year it's always fascinating to get my topic, you know, when Mike has given it to me in the past, because I feel like sometimes Mike has an idea for what he wants the topic to be, but the topic is vague enough that I don't have a clue what he wants. And, you know, there was one year where the topic was word perfect, and I'm like, that sounds really interesting, but I don't know what he's going for. So I'm like Googling word perfect and trying to figure all this stuff out. Well, in contrast, this year I have the longest message title I've ever had in my life that Marshall has given to it. Has like all the bullet points in it and everything. How getting the message out starts to change us individually and transform our congregation. So I have I noticed that with Bill's message. I'm like, it's a 3-point sermon just in the title. So, it's great to be back. Like I said, I really look forward to this and, love the, topic that we're taking a look at, because that should be the very fiber of our existence and our spiritual goals, with the things that we do. And, I'm really interested to look at this particular topic, and I think it's there's definitely a little bit of divine involvement that Marshall gave me that, because that's something that I really think about and dwell on, and we've had some interesting experience with that in Connersville that I want to kind of share today, that I hope ultimately really gives you some encouragement, but also points out the investment that this really is, what this really does. You know, something that's happening in our society right now is there are a lot of denominational churches that are dying out. I work with realtors a lot in my, you know, in the business that I have, and I actually had a realtor tell me a while back that it is amazing to see how many church buildings are on the market. And what is also fascinating is how a lot of those church buildings fall within the realm of a couple specific denominations. And it's almost like society has realized that those denominations they had a spark of conviction in a certain generation, but then they were content to hold to that spark inside those walls and had absolutely no effort for souls or to spread their theology or anything outside of those walls, outside of that group. What ends up happening is you have this generation that had this spark of conviction that gets older and gets older and gets older and gets older. And while they're raising up the next generation in the church, that generation is not instilled with any type of desire for making disciples or evangelism or faithfulness or anything. And so many times, you know, the horror of law mentality snuffs out that generation. That generation takes off and leaves. And you just have this group that gets older and older and older and older and dies. And that happens, that's happening in a couple denominations. It's happening in a lot of Restoration Movement churches. I mean, you're in the Midwest. I mean, head out into the country for probably 15 minutes and you'll come across a little Church of Christ that has 4 or 5 older members of the congregation that show up on Sunday, and a time's going to come where that building's going to go up for sale. And the reason is while those individuals, it seems like a conviction sparked and they desired to hold to that conviction, there was something seriously missing that caused a renewal of life and caused energy to maintain. And, you know, coupled with this issue is society at this point is producing a youth that simply doesn't care about this kind of stuff. You know, we are in this political and social, cultural environment of acceptance. That's what it is. You know, your level of maturity is determined by your willingness to accept whatever others want to be and whatever others want to do. And that mentality really butts heads with any type of rules or expectations. Any type of encouragement to be something specific, which is exactly what God calls us to be. And so, you know, these things combined, you're ending up with, you know, single generations that move on and there's no new life and there's no new effort. And to me, that is one of the greatest fears and things that we need to be careful of, that doesn't happen within our congregation, that we don't slowly begin to build that bubble around us where new life can't penetrate. You know, for those of you that knew Dave Fagan from Connersville, Dave was a big restoration movement buff. I mean, he loved it. And, you know, loved the history, loved, you know, for any of those of you who have read his Things Every Christian Should Know book, you know, he would hit on the key members of the restoration movement. And you could tell that he really thought about and analyzed where they were at spiritually. Because they took great he always respected them that they took great steps to come out of an idea that was just so wrong, but it took guts to step out of that, you know. So Dave always, you know, a lot of his points, a lot of his thoughts, you know, at times would mention the restoration movement, but he always had a phrase that he used quite often that I've never forgotten. And have thought a lot about. And it seems like every generation has to have their own restoration movement. And I've thought a lot about that. And even the way he worded it seemed to be a little saddening. Because he didn't say every generation has to. He said it seems like. That's what has to happen. And I've thought a lot about that. And what he was saying is the very problem that I've mentioned. It seems like a generation will have a spark of conviction, but for some reason that doesn't pass on, you know, to new generations and new life and new energy. It's almost as if you have to get years down the road and a new generation has to, from within, create this spark of conviction, and it just doesn't seem that should be the way it is. There's something seriously missing there if every generation has to have its own restoration movement. There should be a continuance. There should be growth. There should be this constant renewing of life. You know, that problem, I think it comes with the things that I've mentioned, but you know, humans it's the fleshly desire to become complacent. You know, the honeymoon period always wears off. That's always really hard with me when you have a new Christian or you have that new study opportunity and you're trying to work with someone and there is that sincere desire to learn and to understand and to grow and to do things. And the honeymoon period always goes away. It always wears away. That time of excitement or that time of conviction, living in the physical universe, it just naturally begins to fade. And that happens in everything. You know, we look at marriages and, you know, my encouragement would always be to people is that, listen, this time is going to go away, the time of maybe excitement and energy and newness. But the goal is that as that goes away, you end up with sincere devotion and a committed love. You know, that's what should happen. Unfortunately, you know, the problem that we have, or that so many marriages have, is they're so focused on the newness and the excitement, they're not working on developing the commitment and developing the devotion. Well, as Christians, it's the same thing. You know, we would hope that whenever that honeymoon period wears off, we have an excitement to love God, love others, and a walk of faith. You know? That's what should happen. Okay? There should be that love of God, that love of others, that effort to give of myself for the benefit of others. But sometimes that doesn't end up happening. People are happy to exist within their complacency. They're happy to do that. And again, it creates a stop. It creates a block for people. And I am convinced, as I think everyone here would be, is that there is essentially one answer to that problem, and it is a consistent effort of evangelism. It, you know, whenever you look at the idea of evangelism and reaching out, you know, we are spiritual people and the physical means nothing. There is this constant renewal of life and this constant renewal of energy. And what's so neat about that is it spans across all generations. It's exciting to see a new 60-year-old Christian. It's exciting to see a young married couple that come to Christ, you know, and just the different areas of life that they're in. And if that is happening consistently, suddenly the physical generation means nothing. You know, there is no dominant physical generation growing up in the church and getting, and the church modifies around that existing generation as their kids get older, or as they get older, and as they, that's not happening because there's new life coming in everywhere. It's been over 3 years now, which blows my mind, but I worked in banking for a number of years, and my last employer was a very large bank, and I was often fascinated just by some of the decisions made at the bank. It was a very long, tedious process for us to onboard a new employee. Okay. We would hire a new employee. Of course, they have benefits. They have to go through all the background checks. They have to do all this stuff. And then we would start a training regimen for that employee that by the time I left the bank, it was designed to span almost 4 months of training. Okay. I mean, you're in the financial industry. They're dealing with customers. They have access to things. They wanted to make sure they were good. And, a frustration I had with my former bank is just that the employee environment, like a lot of large corporations, had got very unfriendly. It just wasn't accommodating to a lot of employees. And I remember at one point, shortly before I left the bank, that bank's 90-day turnover rate was 50%. So do the math. It takes 4 months to onboard and train a new employee, and their turnover rate at 90 days was 50%. And there are a lot of larger corporations. You know, I worked for another bank prior to that I had a lot more respect for as far as the employee environment, but I still saw just a level of turnover that I never saw in local homebound banking institutions. There was just a different environment. And, I was pretty quick to often say, why hasn't someone put a pencil to this and actually quantified the cost of this turnover? I mean, this has got to be expensive to do this. Not to mention the customers don't get the right service, and, you know, you have an employee force that may not have the knowledge that you think it would need. And I thought of something a while back that I started to realize it was almost as if some larger corporations seem to not only be okay with, but embrace the reality of turnover. And I think the reason that they did, and keep in mind that the banking industry has largely moved into a progressive sales type environment. And I think one of the reasons that they did is the new energy and the new life that came into the bank through that turnover. You know, a lot of times, especially in the field of banking, as it shifted so much from kind of a service style industry to more of an aggressive sales industry, a lot of the issues that the bank had with their policies were with employees that had been there the longest, because they were sort of resistant to that adjustment or resistant to that change. So they would bring in, you know, new youth or new life, and even though they were dealing with this turnover rate, partly that came with the millennial generation, you know, and moving from place to place as they do, it's almost as if the company embraced it, because the new energy and the new life and the new willingness to jump in and try to make things happen actually had a greater benefit than the cost of the turnover. And I thought that was interesting, because at first that made no sense to me. But that reality of new energy can have a really profound effect, in this case, in an organization that is trying to expand its relationships. And I think about that with the church. That's so important, to have that new life with new contacts and new links to other people. You know, they could have an impact on someone that someone else may have been trying for years. And they have that new inroad and that new attachment. And it's just this amazing picture of this constant spreading of the light of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But as far as what it does to the congregation, I am convinced that if that is not in place, fast forward 100 years and you're done. You know? Let's head off to the Church of Laodicea. See how they're doing. You know? The churches written to by John in Revelation. You know, I mean, you look at these things. The Restoration Movement churches. I mean, it seems like such a short period of time. You're talking 230 years and they're gone. 230 years of this massive spark of conviction, and they've faded to nothing. And the reason is that a consistent effort of making disciples and reaching out wasn't accomplished. It wasn't focused on. And I think that's so important. So, you know, with this topic, yeah, again, I thought it was really neat that Marshall gave me this. It's kind of hard to speak on, you know, the effect that it has on you individually and the effect that it has on your congregation. Because to me, it's one of those things that you can talk as much as you want to, but until it's experienced, it's hard to really convey in words. You know, I remember when I was younger, and for those of you who know, this is just the way I am. You know, I was always trying to figure out, how much money do you actually have to live? You know, I remember thinking, like, if this person makes this, and you have to, you know, you got this, you got to buy this, and they have kids, and you got to do that, and, you know, how much do you actually need to do that stuff? And I still do that stuff a lot of times with businesses and things. We have a dinner theater in Indianapolis that we enjoy going to every once in a while. And, you know, you pay that money, you're there for a good meal, and you're there to watch the show. I'm sitting there the whole time trying to figure out their annual revenue. And I'm just like, man, you know, I'm counting the people and counting the tables, and I'm like, this much per ticket, and I bet they pay their servers lower because they work on tips, and they got this meal. But how much are they paying the actors and the actors? Like, are they doing, you know? And part of that, you know, I mean, I've gotten to the point in my life where I've done that for businesses. I've analyzed businesses before, but a lot of times, you know, you can do all that analysis, and there's something always different. There's always something that you didn't account for. There's always unknowns. You know, years ago, I've openly told people I like investing in real estate as opposed to business, because to me there are so many less unknowns in real estate. I can look at, you know, when I've purchased apartments, I can calculate a vacancy rate based off of my history. And then I know what my rents are going to be, and I can look up taxes, insurance, and I can do a pretty solid calculation of assessing what that thing's going to do. Well, years ago, someone pointed me to a storage facility, and I thought, you know, this might work with what I do, because it's like rentals. It's just there's a bunch of them, and they're garages, you know. So the realtor takes me out there in January. I ask if I can go look at it. And I get out of the car in January. I remember there was snow on the ground. He's like, what are you doing? And I said, I'm going to use the locks on the garages to determine the occupancy rate. That way I can kind of see how this thing flows and how revenue should work. And you know, I remember them, you know, they stayed in the car. They were following me around. But I was walking around and I was counting how many had single locks on it and how many had double locks on it that were delinquent, you know. And I went back and did all my numbers calculations and everything, and I ended up buying the property. The guy that owned it he had built it 25 years ago, and I was pretty confident of what I was going into. Well, I failed to realize that the former owner was donating about 20 lockers for free on a monthly basis. So that threw out my whole calculations because 20 of those locks didn't represent revenue, didn't represent any money coming in. And in fact, it represented my obligation to give free lockers for a while. So, you know, there's always something. You know, there are things that you can talk about, but until you experience those things, there can just be unknowns. There could be things that you're not familiar with. And in my experience, evangelism is the same way. It really rocks you individually. It really changes the way that you consider things. And I think it has a pretty profound effect on your congregation. And I want to look at a couple of those. Go to 2 Peter chapter 3:9. For me, I remember one of my first Bible studies, and still, every time that you work with someone, I think when you're involved in the work of making disciples, it makes you reconsider or reevaluate what your take has been on God's grace and His love for mankind. Because it's easy after a while just to get an idea of, you know, God really wants the souls of men, but maybe not those men. You know, I mean, those people are never going to be interested, and they're never going to be there. And I mean, it's just never going to fit. It's never going to work. And I don't know about the effort and time to go into that. And you know, there's just so many details there that really, really, really challenges your mind, challenges your ideas of love and self-sacrifice in evangelism when you do that. And you know, in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 9 is a common passage. The Lord is not slow about His promise, as come count slowness, but is patient toward you, not wishing for any to perish, but for all to come to repentance. You know, for most of, you know, for many years, I thought that meant he's slow about His promise because He's being patient towards the lost people to come to Christ. And that's not who He's being patient towards. He's patient towards you. He's patient for us to have an impact because He is not willing that any should perish. 1 Timothy 2:4, God desires all men. All men. You know, I'll never forget that, you know, the years down at Sunshine with Jim Spinotti in his classes. One of the most profound things I think I ever remember Jim saying is all mean all. And there's so many interesting passages where he said, does all mean all here, you know? In this case, all means all. God desires all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. All men. And that just blows through any kind of ideas we have culturally or politically or that are infused in us by our society or our opinions or anything else, that God desires all men. President Trump, yeah, God desires that all men would be saved. President Obama, yeah. All men. Putin? Yeah. Yeah. Kim Jong-un? The psycho, that's all we hear in the news. This psychopath wants to kill us all. Yeah. The Michigan Wolverines? Yeah. I really assessed that, and I figured I'd be better off saying Michigan than the Cleveland Cavs. So, all men. Desires all men. All men to be saved. And that's hard, I think. You know, as an individual, it's interested me before. You know, we have We have brothers and sisters in the kingdom that had absolutely no experience in the church as youth. None. And then we have others that grew up in the church. And one thing I've identified that is actually a bit of a hurdle for those of us that grew up in the church is a lot of time and effort is spent teaching us godly principles and godly ideals to develop godly character. But a time comes where we start talking about making disciples of all the people that completely contradict all those very ideals and that very character that we've been taught. And that's hard to get over. You know, I mean, when I was a kid, and while I'm convinced at this point that it wasn't properly taught in context, bad company corrupts good morals, right? Avoid all appearances of evil, right? You know, that's what was taught to me in order to not get in with the wrong crowd and to have godly character and be a godly youth so that I could be a strong Christian one day. But then you start talking about seeking and saving the lost. You know, one of my first Bible studies was with a guy that he was a former, had a bad drug problem formerly years earlier, and he was working for a heating and air company in Connersville, and I had known them and got the chance to meet him, and he was really interested in a Bible study. When we kind of talked, he wanted to know kind of where I'd learned things, and I said, hey, you know, the Bible. Why don't we sit down and look at the Bible? And you know, he was married, and they had two young children, and this was really early on, and we had had our first daughter, and she was 1 year old. And for those that know, you know, we're excited about all of our children, but our first daughter was extremely precious because we didn't think we could have children and had tried hard to have children. And it just was amazing to me as we tried to invest time into that relationship and that family. You know, a time came pretty quickly where they said, can we have dinner? You know, we'd like to treat you guys to dinner. We'd love for you to come to our apartment and have you for dinner. And at the time, you know, I'm saying this to try to make it real, but I'm trying to show people. This guy and his wife smoked 3 packs a day. I mean, there was a haze of smoke, you know, in the apartment, which I had no problem with studying. You know, I mean, no, absolutely no issue. But a time came to show love towards that family by uniting our families together and bringing our precious 1-year-old infant daughter into a very heavy atmosphere of cigarette smoke. And that sounds like a minor thing, I think, to most of you. And at the time, it just was this amazing consideration I'd never thought of. I'd never thought of at the time, you know? I mean, our plan in raising our daughter was to keep her from potentially harmful things. I mean, that's just simple, you know? I mean, we had chosen not to do that because we didn't want to harm ourselves and we didn't want to harm our children. But now a time came where to show love towards the souls of others and truly show the compassion and the empathy that Bill was talking about. We had to, I remember we were talking and it's like, okay, so the question comes down to, what's more important? You know, the souls of men or maybe our little bit overprotectiveness of our daughter in this environment? And then you have to ask yourself, is God capable of dealing with those little things in the scope of eternity, in the scope of souls of the souls of men? And that may sound ridiculous to you guys, but it was something, as you start to get into that, those are the kind of things you start to consider. You know, going to Belarus, I'm so thankful that I've been able to be part of Direct Connect and be part of that work. And I'll be honest, I have a little bit of a pet peeve whenever Mike or Steve do presentations. And, you know, I have great respect for them getting up and trying to convey to the brethren in the United States what this work consists of. And my pet peeve is that sometimes I feel like they have the need to give disclaimers. they have the need to give disclaimers because at first appearance, something we did might seem a little out of kilter to what the brethren might perceive as evangelism. You know? I mean, we spend time with a Pentecostal church while they're praying in tongues. Well, I grew up in the church, and that's the type, you know, there's some falsehood there that I'm very convicted against. But we spend time there because the souls of men are more important, you know? One of the most special things to me that I've done in 5 trips in Belarus is we bought Mama Nina a cow. To me, that was one of the most evangelistic efforts of money spent ever. Mama Nina is a sweet gal that takes care of anywhere from 10 to 15 orphan kids in her house at any given time. Legally, 10, but sometimes they give her more, you know. And she's just an amazing woman. And when we were there, when we first met her, she needed a cow because they're largely self-sustaining. She's got turkeys and chickens running around, and she had a cow, but the cow wouldn't cooperate and wouldn't give milk, and she needed a cow. So we bought her a cow, and I thought that was so. But buying a cow, how in the world does that have anything to do with making disciples? Buying a cow or spending time willingly sitting and empathizing with someone who may be teaching off kilter a little bit of Scripture so that you can form a relationship for a future opportunity. I think sometimes I'm happy to spread the seed, but it won't grow over there. You know, I'm not going to go over there and spread the seed. You know, I'll do it over here because I think it has the best opportunity of success. And I think that chart really starts to change your mind. You know, thinking through things where in Belarus, actually, you know, bringing someone to Christ and getting them in the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ, but then dealing with decisions of how you advise them to live that Christian life and assemble where there's not a lot of good choices in Belarus for them to assemble with the saints and actually get the food that they need spiritually. I mean, that just flies the whole, what do you mean? You know, you encourage Christians to assemble on the first day of the week and break bread. I mean, they gotta be there if they're not getting the magic pill, you know, with the people with the right name on the building. That doesn't work. Well, you know, how do I preserve their soul? How do I encourage them? How do they truly grow? How do you have an impact? You know, in those efforts of evangelism, questioning your effectiveness, questioning your efforts, questioning the resources that, you know, all of those things you don't consider, I don't think, in evangelistic work until you're doing it. And it just makes you think. It has an impact on you because we are stewards of the grace God has given us. And I don't know about you guys, but I want to make sure I'm doing that effectively. And I want to make sure I'm using those resources for God's glory. And all of these things, I think it's just, I can sit here and talk about the effect it will have on you, but until you experience those things and get out and do it, it really causes you to consider deeper God's grace. You know, people are they're naturally accustomed to the status quo. They don't. I mean, I've never really met anyone that embraces change. You know, it's really not natural. I mean, if the spiritual man, yeah, absolutely, the spiritual man is ready to do what's needed, but this hunk of flesh doesn't want to. Well, don't do it. And people get used to what they're used to. We were at a hotel recently, and it was a nightmare trying to explain to our 3-year-old why there were commercials and why we couldn't fast forward through the commercials. She had no idea. She's, what is this? Where is PJ Masks? Where'd it go? Who wants to look at this car? You know, I mean, had no idea. Trying to explain, you know, I mean, it's funny, you know, that generation before me was you had to explain why there were three channels and no remote, you know, but we have to explain to the child why you can't fast forward time and eliminate everything that you want to eliminate. But, you know, she was used to, I watched PJ Masks, no commercials, on demand. When I, you know, we had to watch cartoons on Saturdays. And for them, it's you could watch it on 27 TVs 24 hours a day if you want to. But they're used to what they want. The natural tendency is to resist change. That's just what it is. But that's the effect that it has on you, is it causes you to change your thing. You know, we can talk all day about, you know, putting yourself last, putting others first, loving others, but that happens organically within the process of evangelism. That is when you truly begin to realize that I put myself back here. My comforts, my opinions, things that I think about that really aren't important. It begins to create those momentary light afflictions for the benefit of the soul involved. I don't have a ton of, I don't know, what's my time? Do I go to, okay. I really debated on whether or not to tell this story or not. My goal is for it to, I guess, to show really what it can do. Evangelism will have it will rock your congregation to its core. And I'm speaking from a congregation that was formed through that moment of conviction, existed for a while, and then we made a decision as a congregation to really begin to push forward on evangelism. And it was probably about 7 or 8 years ago. And as one of the efforts we were trying to take, we talked about, you know, we had moved into a building and we said, let's go around the community and just say hello. You know, let's form groups, walk around the community, knock on doors, say, hey, we're here. You know, we'd love to be a part of your life. Here's a little thing about us, you know. And, I remember that day, you know, the groups were going around. In my group, we had went to some places and didn't really have any exciting success. And I remember we were about to turn on the street back to the church congregation. And I can't remember if it was me or someone in our group, but we said, why don't we do this strip here? So we did that strip. And we ended up meeting a woman named Kathy. And Kathy expressed interest in, yeah, I'd like to study. So I got a study with Kathy. And Kathy was pretty open. If, you know, big surprise, people in the world have baggage and have things they're dealing with. And Kathy had her share of baggage, and she expressed that to me. She said, here's the deal I want you to know. I got out of prison recently for something, and here's my side of the story. You know, you can take it for what you will. And she said, I was in an abusive relationship with a professional gentleman in a neighboring community. I worked for him as he was a realtor and I was a broker for banks. And part of she said, first of all, the reason I went to prison is because my older son essentially got sick of him abusing me and hauled off on him at the age of 15 or 16. And I was told that my options were to go to prison for conspiracy to commit assault, or my son was going to, his future was going to be. And again, this is her side, you know, her side of the story. And that's fine. You know, I was happy to listen. But she said, I need to let you know that part of the whole problem of that situation is I was doing things with a broker's license at the behest of my, you know, this guy I was in a relationship with that is going to turn into future charges. She said, I'm going to head back to prison at some point. So I in a men's meeting in our congregation, I said, hey, I just want to let you guys know, with respect, I'm not going to go into the details, but, you know, this gal's got some baggage and it could be kind of a rough future, you know, as she's heading to prison. I don't see anything that really would be anything for us to worry about or to be upset about, but I want to let you guys know, and I'll let you know if something changes. So So I studied with Kathy some. I actually ended up, she got married. I performed the wedding, got a study with her husband, you know, and did those things. Well, time moved on, and the moment came where on the front page of the paper of this neighboring community, it came out that she was getting ready to be tried for these, essentially it was mail fraud. She was being charged with mail fraud because she falsified documents with her official license and seal. And that was an interesting experience at our congregation. And I tell this story, in my opinion, sadly, because, you know, we went down, all the men of our congregation went down into the basement, and I was about ready to be lynched, is what I felt. We had guys, you know, terms were used such as, this was a stupid way to approach this. We had a gentleman in our congregation that actually was a banker for one of the banks who was somewhat of a victim of this. And he had conveyed to people that this creates a severe conflict of interest for me because I'm acting in the congregation and helping. And of course, I was trying to make the point where that should be no, if there's a conflict of interest, what's your interest? Is your interest this, you know, but that moment will live in infamy for me a little bit because it was like our congregation. Here's evangelism. Here it is. Dealing with this, with people that do we care about their souls or do we not care about, do we care about our own comfort? And, you know, the end of this, she ended up going to prison for 2 years. I studied with her for 2 years in prison. She got out a little bit early on perfect behavior. You know, I'd like to say that story ends happily, but I had a conversation with her when she got out of prison, and whether it was, you know, whether it was an out, whatever it was, she made the comment to me. She said, "I don't know how I could come back to that congregation. I mean, I don't know. I feel like there are people there that just don't, you know, I mean, not only not care for me, but they would be offended or they would feel weird of me." And sadly, I understood completely. And I remember that moment because it was just, you know, it was so easy to talk about evangelism. And it's so easy to think about, you know, we're going to find people that look just like Jesus. We just have to get them wet. And when it actually came to getting down in the muck and the mire with people and dealing with that kind of stuff and that kind of baggage, and that's what evangelism is. I mean, that does God desire all men to be saved? Does that soul matter? And it mattered. 1 Corinthians 9, I think I'm getting over here, so I'll rush it along, but and I think Bill or Mike, one of the two, you know, hit on this. But again, a passage everyone knows here. 1 Corinthians 9, starting in verse 19. "For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, so that I may win more. To the Jews I became as a Jew, so that I might win Jews. To those who are under law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law, those though not being without law, the law of God, but under the law of Christ, so that I might win those who are without the law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that I may by all means save some. And I do all things for the sake of the gospel, so that I may become a fellow partaker in it." That's what evangelism, that's the impact evangelism has on you individually and on your congregation. You change. And you change completely for the souls of men. You adjust. You begin to think differently. You work differently. You priorities change. You know, time changes. Instead of that time, again, I think it was Marshall. Instead of that time maybe playing ball with your kids, it's that time throwing the kids in the truck and heading off to a Bible study or doing, things change. Marshall, expressed in his text to me prior to this that he really wanted a nuts and bolts kind of approach. And as an analytical person, I appreciate that. And guys, I remember so many examples exist in the physical creation that demonstrate these spiritual things. Great for us to understand. Paul said, I speak in human terms so that you can understand. And childbirth is a terrifying, scary, difficult, painful thing. But you know what's interesting is when that baby is born, none of that really mattered or was relevant. No one is thinking about that kind of stuff. They are just in awe of the new life that has come into the world. That new baby makes all that stuff go away. And that's what evangelism is. I tell these stories, I was hesitant because I don't want it to sound... I want to show how invested you become and how you have to make a decision if this is going to be about the souls of men or if it's going to be about evangelism as you would define it in your nice little bubble of comfort. That new life makes all of that go away. It does amazing things. And my exhortation to you guys today in thinking of that is, as a member of the body of Christ, be as effective as that member individually within the working of the body. A couple comments have been made this morning that I really appreciate because I become more and more convicted. Evangelism is a team sport. I mean, it really is. It's been hard for, I didn't know if I wanted to convey this in a sermon, but, I know at times I've felt that, you see in the scripture that we're the body of Christ and that the hand shouldn't look at the foot and say, I have no need of you. And the foot shouldn't look at the hand and say, well, I'm not a hand. I don't know if I can be effective. I think at times I want us to be careful to not say, well, listen, you be whatever member of the body that you can be, but make sure you're being a mouth. You may be a foot, but you need to be a mouth some of the time. You may be a hand, but you got to act like a mouth some of the time. Guys, I think it's vital for us to realize that it is a team sport. One thing I was so happy with that effort with Kathy, is I was the one, I was a 25-year-old male. She was a 40-year-old female. There wasn't a lot of common ground. She had sons that were 10 years younger than me. What I loved is I showed up and I was able to talk to her, speak about things in her life, show her the scripture. But when I left, there were women in our congregation calling her up to, let's go to the movies. Let's go out to eat, And I appreciated that so much because to me it showed that teaching was important, that demonstration of Christ and the proclaiming the gospel. But she was going to be, an individual is going to be more won by what you do and what's done to them, the compassion and love shown to them than what's said to them. I'm convinced of that. I mean, there's enough people out there that can say things way fancier than any of us can say. I was watching TV the other day. Has anyone heard of Peter Popoff? You haven't heard of Peter? I couldn't believe it was on television. Primetime television. Peter Popoff's, what was it called? Peter Popoff's, I think it was just Miracle Water. Peter, you haven't heard of Peter Popoff's Miracle Water? This guy is selling ketchup packets of water that you sprinkle on yourself and encounter a miracle, There are people who can sell stuff better than anyone in this room is what I'm talking about, okay? There's people out, they're going to hear that stuff everywhere. I mean, we live in a nation, supposedly, that is a Christian nation. You throw a rock in Connersville, you hit a church building. The difference is going to be how the body interacts with that individual. how the body expresses love, how the body expresses compassion and empathy towards that individual. And that is that investment by the body is what creates new life. I'll finish up here, but I had this as optional in my sermon, but I want to talk about it. I'm a beekeeper now. I became really fascinated in honeybees. And Jeff Eckerly out in Montana, you know, he got me a little more interested because he got a hive. And I just got my bees on Wednesday, and I don't think I've killed them yet, okay? But, you know, leading up to that, I did all this research on honeybees and videos and everything. And they, man, you talk about proof of a divine creator, you know? But what's amazing to me in the hive is the huge amount of functions that the bees have and the responsibilities that they have. You know, you have the queen bee who is simply an egg-laying machine. She lays her body weight in eggs every 4 hours. That's what she does, you know? And then you have the worker bees, and those worker bees, over the course of they never sleep. Honeybees do not sleep. They're awake 24 hours a day. And over the course of their life, they have about 10 different functions that they deal with. They may be when they bust out of their cell, their first responsibility is clean up their cell. That's what they do. They clean it up, they get it ready for a new bee. They may have responsibilities where they clean the hive. They may have responsibilities where they take care of the queen and they support the queen. They may have undertaker responsibilities. You know, there's a dead bee, I got to transport it and get it out, you know. They may have foraging responsibilities where they go out. They may have a responsibility where they just stand at the front of the hive and fan the hive to cool the temperature down. They'll just stand there and fan their wings for hours, sometimes a significant percentage of their life, in order to cool the hive down to make it a functioning machine for developing new life and continuing the hive. Awesome example in the natural world of what evangelism in the body of Christ should be, in my opinion. You have a machine where everyone, every single member is performing a vital responsibility that ends up resulting in new life and the functionality of the hive. So, you know, the impact it has on you individually and your congregation, guys, it changes. It is the systematic process of loving an individual, of putting yourself behind the souls of men. And it teaches you that through that experience. But the results, praise God. It's like that new baby. It's like that new life and that new energy. And that is a vital key to the continuance and the growth of God's kingdom. Otherwise, it was like Dave said, every generation ends up having to have its own restoration movement. They have to come out of darkness and a decay of truth and conviction, and have that conviction start all over, and that shouldn't be the way it is. Ephesians 4:15-16, but speaking the truth in love, we're to grow up in all aspects into Him who is the head, even Christ, from whom the whole body, being fitted and held together by what every joint supplies, according to the proper working of each individual part, that causes the growth. The proper working of each individual joint and each individual part causes the growth of the body for the building up of itself in love. Fulfill your role to the best of your ability. Do it the way Christ would do it. Be a part of the work. Be a part of the evangelist. Jump in anywhere you can for the effort of making disciples and seeking and saving the lost. That's what we're here for. It's a glorious purpose that God has charged us with, and we have the ability and the blessing to do it together. Thank you.